Jason, like I said in iMessage, it kind of occurred to me that I'd had you and Andrew on before, and that became the pilot for what is now Hemispheric Views, which I hope people are listening to, another great show, separate from Lounge Ruminator. And I'd had Andrew on before that to talk about his potted computing history, as he called it, but then it clicked that I had never had just you on, and I want to apologize for that, and welcome.
That's actually fine, because if you had said nothing, I already thought that I was on this show previously with just myself. So this, I thought, was my second appearance, but it turns out it's actually my first. So
stored in your memory, what was that show about? Was it good?
Oh, it was a great show. Couldn't tell you what it was about, but man, excellent show. 5 stars.
Beautiful. Thank you. Well, I don't even have to record now. That's just taken all the effort away. So for people who haven't listened to Hemispheric Views or met you virtually through the Rumination Lounge before, do you want to give some background about yourself?
Sure, yeah. I live in the United States. I think people may or may not know that, hence the Hemispheric Views. I live on the West Coast of the United States, mainly lived in California for most of my life, then moved just recently to Portland, Oregon. Other than that, I was in the military for 4 years, so I left and went around the world for a while doing that. I've been working in mostly technology for the better part of my life, personally and professionally. I transitioned into doing more of medical device product innovation in the medical device space for the last probably 8 or so years. And now, like I said, we just moved, so I'm kind of starting a whole new thing now. I'm not really sure where I'm going next. But that being said, tech has always really kind of been the center point for me personally, and then that turned into professional. And now, only now in my life, am I trying to kind of add other things into my life that are less tech-centric and maybe a little more analog.
Okay, before we kick off with the topic that you suggested for today, which is quite, we'll say, technological, how did you, or how have you tried to make things more analog? Can you speak a bit about that? Because most of my dealings with you in conversations, and the one time that we actually did get to meet in person, it's been very tech focused. So what's analog for you now?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think everything at some point nowadays, at least, does wrap back around into technology somehow. I think the definition of technology I'm using here is more, when I say technology, I think I more mean computers more than anything, because really technology is just something that's advanced something that was there previously. So for example, I just recently finished an analog board game. So a physical box with a board and game pieces and cards and so forth. And of course I used computers to create the assets for that. You know, I'm not hand drawing sets of cards or anything like that, but the act of creating something that is an analog medium is new for me. Whereas, you know, 5-10 years ago, if I was going to create a game, I would have gone down the route of creating a computer game. Everything would have been digital or online. Whereas this is the complete opposite, where you're sitting in a room with other people, not online, and actually playing a physical game. Another example, woodworking has been a hobby of mine that I've gotten into quite a bit recently, mostly because we moved. Previously, when we lived in California, we lived in a high-rise condo in the middle of downtown, not really conducive to large hobbies involving lots of tools and machines and dust. So having a much more traditional space now to do such activities has been great, mostly mentally for me, to just get away from sitting in front of a computer and working with my hands and figuring out problems, and, you know, and not using a calculator on your screen, using a tape measure and actually just figuring, working through different measurements on papers has been a very interesting challenge and very rewarding.
Were you a woodworker before?
Nope, not at all. Not even a little bit. I mean, I wouldn't even say I'm technically one now, other than in the sense that I'm physically trying to make things out of wood. It's been a slow progress working through learning how to do these things myself. But even that revolves back around to tech, right? Where, how do I do a thing? Where am I going to figure that out? I could probably go down to the library and find a book on woodworking and work that out. Or I could pull my phone out of my pocket while I'm in the garage working on something and just look at a quick YouTube video on how to do something. the convenience factor really is there for that kind of thing. So the two still overlap quite a bit. And even in terms of technology within woodworking, like not everything is hand saws, right? We have power tools now. So technology works its way into everything. I think it's just a matter of convenience and speed. Just because I want to make the thing doesn't mean I want to take 2.5 years to do it. I'd rather have it done in 2 weeks and then move on to the next thing. So that's just kind of the nature of where we're at as a society, I think, too.
Well, look, I've seen some of the pictures that you've posted on micro.blog and elsewhere of the things that you've built or been doing. It looks like you're quite experienced. You're modest and you say you haven't been doing it for a long time, but I was just instantly reminded of years 7 and 8 in early high school, or what, middle school in the United States, and the woodwork lessons that we had to do. And I made some of the shonkiest products you have ever seen. We had to do this thing which was like a... there was a pencil case with a little notch on it, but then there was also a toolbox and you had to use the lathe to sculpt or kind of curve the handle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, asymmetry was the word that really entered my vocabulary at that time. It was not good. But look, my mum still loves it and uses it today for her craft items.
That's funny. I mean, it's the same thing here in the States, where there's always, you know, wood shop and metal shop and different various shops in school. And the funny thing that I've noticed, I think it's probably generational, but everybody that is in or around my age that did any kind of wood shop in school, it seems like across the board on the entire country, every school makes you make the same damn thing. So everyone has like the same little weird bookshelf looking thing that's kind of at an angle. And it's just, everybody knows when you talk about certain pieces that you made, it's like, oh yeah, I made one of those in eighth grade or whatever it was. So it's interesting. I assume they make different things now, if they even have wood shop and so forth in schools. I'm not sure. I would hope they do, but given the way that schools work here in budgets, I don't know if they even do those kinds of things anymore.
Yeah, well, I remember the people who are actually good at it and went to do that subject as an elective in later years, they would make a coffee table. And I saw the results from some of my friends who are actually good with their hands in things like woodwork class, and I felt unbelievably insufficient. So, yeah, I mean, that was a little while ago now, but I think they still do it. I think they still do it. And it's good that you're continuing that fine woodworking tradition with your new hobby anyway. New hobbies or things like podcasting that we do now, kind of born out of a very interesting year that was 2020 last year. It's been spoken about to death. But the topic that you suggested when I approached you was really bending back around to technology. If the world has really changed, what did you want to say about that, starting us off?
Yeah, I definitely don't think we need to dive into, you know, the pandemic and so forth. But more something that I've been curious about regarding the pandemic is the idea of work and school and how they've pretty much, and you know, obviously speaking from the United States side, so I'd like to hear what your view is on this as well, but largely school and the work environment have been basically the same thing for a very, very, very long time. And we always talk about how we need to advance education and so forth, but yet here we are doing the same thing where it's put, you know, 20 or 30 kids in seats lined up in nice, neat rows with one person at the front talking for an hour, and then go off and do your homework and come back tomorrow and we'll do it again. It's just been a very traditional means of education, and there hasn't been a lot of ways to get out of that system from a student standpoint. You're just very much expected to... you go to kindergarten, you know, you go to middle school, high school, now you're expected to go to college and so forth. And maybe that's where it ends. And that's where it maybe becomes a little bit more based on your family lineage. If it's, you know, well, our family, we always go to get master's degrees or whatever. So you're expected to do that, or you have to go to Harvard because your grandpa went to Harvard, whatever. There hasn't really been a lot of other options. You know, we have online school now, but I would argue it's passable at best, and it really isn't good for everyone. You have to be a very specific kind of person, I think, to do something like an online education. And I think a lot of people are realizing that now, given last year and now, where everyone has been doing the same traditional means of education. And then all of a sudden it was, you're thrown into this new world of you're at your house with everyone else in your house and you're on Zoom or Google Chat or whatever the medium is of choice that they cobbled together at the last minute. And a lot of people are failing because they had never had experience doing this. Flip that on the other side of work and being, you know, you're done with school now and you're into the workforce. And it's kind of the same thing again. You go and you sit in your cubicle and you're like everyone else in your cubicle and you're doing your work. You drove however long it took to get there. You do your work. You drive however long it takes to get home. And it's the same thing over and over, regardless of job, regardless of what you do the same exact thing. And now again, everyone's at home trying to figure out how do I do my work from home? Or I think a lot of people found out, wow, I can do this work from anywhere. Why the heck have I been traveling 2 hours in traffic every morning or on a train to go sit at an office when I'm already have a desk at home? I think a lot of this has been the same. And this has been the first time in my lifetime that I've seen anything regarding work and school change. And it was only because it was absolutely forced and you had no choice. So I am curious now with the kind of most cliche thing people can say is I want it to go back to normal, which I'm not going to say that, but I think most people feel like that's going to happen, whatever that means to them. But I actually wonder if that's true. I'm starting to see some early signs in different ways that this may not just go back to the way it was, and we may actually be forced into doing things a little bit differently now. And that's the premise, I think, of what I was kind of getting at when I talked to you about this earlier.
Yeah, you make some great points, and particularly the whole back to normal thing, because normal is only what we've experienced in our short lifetimes. You think about the whole context of human history, normal has been very different in different times and different places. And when it comes to education, like you said, traditional rows sitting in a classroom. I'm not an educator myself, so I'm not a professional in this area, but a lot of people in my family have been involved in education, either, you know, in direct teaching roles or administrative ways. So I feel like I can say something, but really education is just about being industrial, preparing you for the workforce. And I think there's kind of this, tell me if you agree, this conflict now internally where people say, you know, we need to have more play-based learning or creative or exploratory sort of things. But at the same time, there's more and more of a push to get hyper fast, more and more data, get people ready for the workforce. So you've got kind of got this career ready focus and this, you know, spread your wings and fly creatively mantra, and they're kind of at odds at each other. And then you throw in all of this online education stuff into the mix where how can you really play or be creative when you have to sit staring at a window? You've actually been undergoing or undertaking some online education yourself, haven't you?
I have, yeah.
How have you found that?
Yeah, I've been, I like to call it the longest degree I never wanted. I have been, so like I said, out of high school, I went into the military just because traditional education was never my thing. That was very clear through high school and before that. So I knew that going into a traditional four-year college where it was expected to do all the same stuff, but now no one's really watching you, I knew that would be a failure. So I opted to not go that route. And I went into the military after high school and kind of did that instead of college. And then out of that went directly to work at Cisco Systems out of the military. So I just kind of skipped the college thing and did it a different way. And then decided, okay, now I'm a bit older now and I appreciate it more. So now I'm going to go ahead and try to figure out what I can do in regard to getting a degree. Just, I call it the thing I never wanted because I've never really put a lot of emphasis or care on the act of getting the diploma. To me, and again, it's like my personal view of just education is just you're learning new things. And I never really found it to be, I needed a piece of paper to say that I was done, since we're pretty much always learning all the time. But nevertheless, it's kind of the system we're in. So it was like, okay, play the game, get the certificate and be done with it. So for a while I was working initially, I went to night school to get an associate degree, which is like it's just a 2-year degree. I'm assuming you have those there or something similar maybe?
Yeah, there are things like graduate diplomas and diplomas which are shorter courses, or they have a certain number of credit points that you would have within a bachelor's. So it sounds something
gotcha.
Like that.
Yeah, it's kind of a community college thing where the idea is that you go do this 2 years to get rid of your kind of entry-level basic classes before you go on to finish and do a more focused, specific program. But anyway, I did that at night, got that done, and then was like, okay, well, I've did that, so let's do a little bit more to get the bachelor's degree. Flash forward many, many years, I started and stopped this more times than I can even remember. I just didn't like it. Every time I took classes, it was like, I don't care about this class. Nothing about it interests me. But yet, because of this system, I have to take this class. And it was like, give me a chance to pick from a list. I never understood why it wasn't just, here's 100 different things. Pick the things that interest you and take them. It's never been like that, though. It's always, you're doing this degree, so you have to take these classes. Anyway, I would take some, stop, take some, stop, take some, stop. For work, historically, I've always traveled a ton, and that just never was a good mix for doing school, because I'd always be on the road. And the last thing you want to do after being on the road for couple of weeks straight is be doing classes at night. So again, it was a very easy thing to find excuses to not complete the degree.
It sounds like you're a person who loves learning but has felt restricted by the system of learning. Is that fair?
I would say that's fair, yeah. And the style of learning, just sitting in a room looking at a book and reciting and regurgitating stuff back that I was forced to memorize. Oh, the war of 1890, blah, blah, like, okay, great. That's just not how I work. I need something more. I don't know. That just doesn't work for me. So anyway, 2020 happened, and it looked like we were going to be at home for a while. Well, actually, no, didn't look like we were going to be at home for a while. And then it turned out to be that way. But 2020 was kind of one of those years where, in years leading up to that, 2020 felt like this just magical year. You know, it's 2020. It just was supposed to be this, oh my, everything cool is going to happen this year. It's going to be just everything is going to be great. Well, everything was shit, so.
And the Olympic logo was ruined.
Yeah, it was 220s. Come on. It was going to be epic, but it wasn't. So I had a couple of things on my list that had been lingering on and on and on. One was this board game that I talked about earlier. And one was this school. So I was like, either these get done this year or I'm not doing them anymore. Because every year it would just be this guilt that I would put on myself of, hey, look, there's another thing you didn't finish. Hey, look, you didn't finish that yet. Hey, is that degree done yet? No? Oh, guess what? It's not done yet. And it was just driving me nuts. So it was like, either I'm going to finish it or I'm deleting it and I'm just never going to look at it again. It's getting done one way or the other. You know, dove in, figured out what I needed to do, figured out a plan that I could actually finish in that year if I did this number of classes and whatever. So I got on with the people, blah, 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 got that done, and end of 2020 happened and I actually finished it. So it was January 13th to December 14th. So it was basically the entire year. And got it done.
Well done.
Yes, thank you. So it's done, and I can get it off the list, which was great. But I didn't like any part of it. I looked at it as a chore. I didn't find any enjoyment in it whatsoever. There was one college class that I think I've ever taken. Two, that I found to be absolutely enjoyable, and the reason was the teacher. They knew how to engage me personally.
And how was that?
So both of these classes were actually during this community college thing that I was doing at night. One was a black and white photography class. That's kind of a cheater class because I love photography anyway, so it's kind of hard for me not to be into that class. And the fact that I was allowed to take that as a class that counted, and it was something that I truly enjoyed, winning combination. Everybody wins. Why is there not more of that?
Perfect.
And then the other one was two physics classes. And the guy, when you look at him, you're like, oh yeah, that's a physics teacher, like for sure. He just has that look about him. But he went out of his way to know that physics is not the first thing people jump at when it comes to learning. Unless you're in, you know, that's your thing, sure. But in a general sense, no. So I think he named his class something like physics for poets.
Oh,
something along those lines. And it was just like this, what the heck, what is that? Is it a poetry class? Is it what is this class? And it, you look at it, it counts towards your science, you know, needs. And I was like, all right, I'll take that. And he was just the most genuine guy about having hands-on means of learning physics versus just sit in the class and learn. And he made that very apparent up front. This class is going to be hands-on. If you want to be the person that sits in the back of the class, you should probably go do a different class because this is not for you. And we're not going to have a textbook. We're not. It was very like new age. What is it? Is this guy even a real teacher? Is he supposed to be here? Is this legal? Can we do this? And that was probably one of my favorite classes I've ever taken.
And as far as poets goes in the title, was there any connection to things in the arts or humanities or just general life?
He often...
Well, that was more... He was more of a marketing guy.
I think he was more of a marketing guy. He did often go off into tangents of like, somehow this is related to physics, but we're not really sure why. But really, it was that title to get you. It was his hook. He got you in. Because he made it sound not like a big, long, you know, the name of the class was not a physics equation that was going to like turn you off and make you freeze. Like, oh, I don't like math. I don't like that. No, this class was just, it was a great intro to physics. And he also did some astronomy classes that I took with him as well. And it was because of him. That was it. I'm a fan of astronomy. I think it's great. But I wouldn't have probably picked it as a class had it not been his class. Yeah, so the online thing, though, so sorry, flipping back to this last year, didn't like one bit of it. It was awful. It was just a lot of doing work for doing work's sake. It felt like the classes were very just checking the box. You know, a class needs to have these 10 things, so we're going to give you these 10 things, and that's pretty much it. And I wouldn't even say it wasn't the school, it wasn't the university. I'm not saying like this university sucked or whatever. I think that's just no one really knows how to do it yet. And it's always been an afterthought where you go to college and then, oh, by the way, we also have online. So here you go. Yeah, so I got it done. It was fine. I don't really feel like I took much away from it. And especially given how much education costs in the United States, I think every class that I took was somewhere in the range of around $2,000, maybe more, 20.
Wow.
$2,000 to $3,000 per class, something.
And you're talking US dollars.
Yeah, USD, something in that arena. Already, so now you've got the debt issue, which is that's probably a whole nother thing we could talk about, but just the sheer amount of money that it costs to get this piece of paper that's supposed to be so magical. And yet, what is it really doing? From the other side, from a management standpoint, having been working for quite a while, I can count the number of times that we've had new grads as new hires, and I just don't feel like they were ever really prepared to actually do work. It felt like they were being prepared to do schoolwork, but not real life work. And that has always been concerning to me.
It's a very, very tricky issue that you bring up because I often think back, you've reminded me actually, I think it was back in my first or second year of university when we were on campus, so this is years ago now, what I frequently came across was other students who would complain that they felt that they weren't learning practical skills for their work. Now, that may seem fair enough, but they would refer to very, very specific things. And I was doing a communications course with some marketing subjects thrown in, and they would talk about how, why aren't they showing us how to use a content management system like a CMS, which I suppose is a fair enough argument. But then I would say, which one? You know, it's very hard for the university or any other kind of educational institution to just specify exactly how to do this practical skill. And then there's the argument that you're not learning enough critical thinking skills or theory. So it's very hard to balance this. But I do agree, linking back to what you said about that physics for poets guy, that you want to try to take concepts and show how they are applicable to real life or how you can use them every day. So how do you think, given what you just said, is the best way for education, online or not, to prepare young people to be ready for jobs? What were some of the skills that you saw as lacking?
I think one was time management. Time management and just the, call it a human decency of just respecting other people's time. so often there will be a class and it starts at 8 o'clock. People roll in at 8:05, 8:10, 8:30. Nothing said, doesn't matter. That just means it's okay. So now flash forward to, I call a staff meeting at 9 a.m. and people are rolling in at 9:05, 9:10. Oh, sorry, I'm late. No, there's no excuse for that whatsoever. Yes, sometimes things happen and people are, you know, they are late to a meeting or whatever, but it just seems like that has become the culture now of, oh, we'll start 10 minutes late. Then why did you have the start time set to 9? Set it to 9:10. Just things like that where you're not respecting the fact that you being 5 minutes late is not just you being 5 minutes late. You've now wasted 5 minutes times the 35 people in this room times their collective salaries times what they're going to be late to next. And it just compounds on itself. And there's so much wasted time and money that is just written off as like, eh, oh, well, you know, I was late to a meeting. That to me is just unacceptable. I don't know how that kind of thing is not enforced more so in the college environment. If you're supposed to be preparing people for life, prepare them for life. And not for their life, but for other people's life. I think so much of college, to me anyway, felt like it was for me to figure out what I'm supposed to do versus what I'm supposed to do in conjunction with the rest of society. We're all one thing that's supposed to work together. You're just one of the little pieces of the puzzle in the whole entire world puzzle, yet everything is always about you. You know, what did you do? Are you doing this? Are you going to be going to that? Well, what is it? How does that affect everyone around them? They try to do that with like group projects, but anyone that's ever been a part of a group project knows that that just means you're doing five people's work now instead of one. Because all too often, group projects to the vast majority of people is, how do I do the least amount and still make this happen, if at all? That doesn't work in the real world when you're getting paid a salary. That may work for a science project you're doing, you know, in third year, whatever, but you show up to an office, I'm not going to do your work for you. And you can't expect to be handheld through every single thing. I don't think there's a good translation between college and the real world. And I have to imagine a lot of that is that there's really, it's hard to enforce consequences in a college environment.
Oh, sure.
Because it's the complete opposite. You're paying to be there versus someone paying you. So it's hard to say, hey, give us all your money. And also we're going to yell at you when you do something wrong. And then it's like, how do you balance that? Whereas in the workplace, they're paying you. So it's just a very hard thing to translate. And I don't know how you do that. So much of that I think comes down to what were you like before you went into college too? Because I think that may be even more important. I don't think you're going to put someone through college and all of a sudden they're ready for the world. I don't think it works that way.
Yeah, and you can't expect universities or colleges to be job factories. We don't want to lose the capacity for creative thinking, different ideas. Actually, I don't know if this is something that necessarily fixes it, but thinking back again to those same university days, there were certain subjects that I remember that were fantastic for challenging people. And when I say challenging people, I don't just mean challenging their critical thinking, but throwing them into situations where people had different ideas or different disciplines. There was this fantastic first year subject that I did, which was a core subject for me. It was part of the major that I was doing. It was called Media Ethics and Law, which may or may not sound interesting to people listening. But the thing that was really cool about it was that it kind of had two university subject codes. On the one hand, it was media. On the other hand, it was philosophy. But all of these different people from different degrees, even courses that had nothing to do with those, even things in business or elsewhere, would end up being funneled into this either because it was recommended in their own major or they could choose it. So you just had this melting pot of all of these different people of different ages and backgrounds, different study interests. And it was essentially a subject about how no matter what you're into or no matter what sort of work you're doing, media are going to be a part of it. And you've got to think about the ethics and the legalities of what you're doing. And there were some really, really fascinating topics. So I kind of wonder if there's a need to have more subjects that are broader or go beyond the specialization that people have so that they're forced to think, oh, how does that person think? Or what would that workplace be like? Or how do I have to function when I enter the real world and deal with different people outside of my maths degree or my science degree or my business qualification, you know, just thinking differently.
Yeah, it's I kind of think of it akin to learning a new language, really, where mm-hmm. if you were to learn Spanish, you can now communicate with people that speak Spanish, where if you're in some field that has nothing to do with design, but you take a design course and learn some of the fundamentals of design, and then you go into a workplace where you may be nothing to do with the product team at all. Maybe you're in finance or something like that. But the fact that now when you go speak to somebody in that role or they speak to you, you have a better understanding of what their role actually is, versus just saying, oh, they're in marketing, so they just spend all the money. Or they're, you know, they're the engineers, so they just do nerdy computer stuff all the time. And it's like, okay, kind of, but having a better understanding of what everyone else on your team slash company does can only benefit you as well as them, because that's going to get you both to the end goal that much quicker. To your point, I think choice is what would be my biggest concern in school, in that if you go to do a degree, why do you have to be stuck in this one thing? I guess that's where I don't understand. And I think maybe that's a big US thing too, where it's like, there's always the question of what do you want to be when you grow up? And it's like, why are we so defined by jobs?
It's the same here.
You go to a meeting, or sorry, a meeting. Not, look, I'm already talking about work. I'm not even working.
There you go.
Damn it. You go to any kind of an event and you meet someone, 9 out of 10 people, the very first question, oh, what do you do?
Mm.
And it's like, well, oh, for work? I didn't realize this was a work thing. Well, I do this and that. It doesn't matter. It's just become kind of a formality almost, where it's the initial kickoff of what do you do? Oh, well, I do this. Oh, okay. Well, let me flex about what I do now. And it's like, who gives it? Who cares? Like, we're not here
to, it's a great point.
We're not here to work together. We're just like, you know, at a barbecue or something. So I don't know why I get annoyed when things are just so focused on work and everything is about work, and then everything else in your life becomes secondary.
Which is fascinating, because, you know, we all have multiple identities or different personas depending on who we're talking to, who we're working with, or the hobbies that we enjoy. Perfect example, beginning of this very podcast episode, you were talking to me about woodwork. That probably has nothing to do with anything that you've ever done personally in your professional life, but it's now a big part of your identity and you get to share it with people online, and people like me, we get to enjoy it. So I totally agree with you that everything is so skewed to thinking economically. We think about education and how things have to change given what's happened over the past year. A lot of the dialogue or the discourse that I'm hearing is about helping the economy, at least here in Australia. And I think, well, it's about people's lives, it's about their mental health, it's about being creative and doing hobbies and things with your time. And education feeds into that too. So if we think it's all for the economy, that's going to end up influencing how we think about our learning as well.
Yeah. Economy, same here, obviously. It's just, it's the topic of the hour in terms of what's going on around here. The thing with education too is that so much, it's like we put so much emphasis on it, yet in reality, in a very broad sense, it's a very hard thing to attain for the vast majority of people, given just the barrier to entry of cost. Just that alone makes it almost impossible for the majority of people to get these degrees that all these companies covet so much. Then you look at, okay, well, they can't do that. And then you go one level deeper. Well, that's because they're in, you know, this demographic. Okay. Then that also means that demographic means they're only allowed to go to these high schools or these middles. And it's just all the way down throughout a person's life, they're constantly kind of assessed on their financial status more than anything else. That's what's really getting the education. At the end of the day, I've always said you're just buying a piece of paper, because that's kind of what you're doing. You're not really earning it through merit. If you're on a scholarship, I guess you could say that. But at the end of the day, there's an exchange of a piece of paper for a bunch of money. It's a business. All these schools are businesses. They are there to make money and keep the books in the black and not in the red and make sure everybody is paid very well. Yet the exchange for goods doesn't seem equal in terms of what someone is getting related to the amount of money they spend. And then you get done with college and you think you're done, And then the college just hits you up for the rest of your life to give them free money after you just gave them a crap ton of money for the education. They just want more free money until you die. It's insane. It's where is this money going? I don't understand.
People need to think about whether they want to go to university, not if they should, because I think everyone should have the chance to experience higher education if there's something of interest to them. There shouldn't be, you know, a huge barrier to entry, and I'm certainly aware of the privilege that I have to continue doing higher education or to have done it at all. But I think people need to think about, you know, what kind of job skills they want, what they want to get out of their education, whether it's something they want to commit themselves to in the long run, because there's also this feeling that I observe where everyone thinks that they have to go into university, or in the US, college now. It's like expected, kind of like that dinner party question of what do you do? If you don't, then somehow you're failing or not doing the right thing. And then you see fewer people with, you know, trade skills, for example, in Australia. You know, we need people like electricians and plumbers and people who deal with infrastructure, and they're very respectable and useful jobs, and that's learning in a different way. So sometimes I think we're too skewed to thinking that university is the only answer as well.
Yeah, and in terms of the trade school thing, that's super annoying how much it's not only is it just looked at as not as good, it's actively looked down upon, I feel like, a lot in the United States. And yet you have somebody that'll drive down the road and moan about a pothole or, you know, something wrong with the city's infrastructure. And then on the same side, it's like, oh, tradespeople, that's below me. No, it's not. I don't see why someone can come out of high school and say, you know what, 4-year degree to do finance or something is not for me. I would much rather go to a 2 or 3 year thing to learn how to fix cars or something like that.
Yep.
Great. That's perfect. Go for it. The option is there. You should be able to do that and not be looked at as you're doing something less than somebody that went to, you know, whatever school. And to that point, like the question of, well, what do you do? The same thing happens when you initially go into the workforce of like, oh, where did you go to school? It's the same thing all over again. It's just layers of it. Where did you go to school? And then after a while, then it becomes, oh, what do you do? It's like, it's never about you. It's always about what you were associated with in terms of college or work. And that was always a fun question. Where'd you go to school? I didn't.
Yeah, and imagine what the world would be like and conversations in general if upon starting that job, that person were asked, what brought you here? Or what do you enjoy learning about? Or what motivated you to undertake this kind of work?
I always loved the reaction to that when I first started working. And inevitably, the question always came up of, where'd you go to school? And I would just say, I didn't. And the look of horror on people's faces was just like, what do you mean? How
really?
You didn't go, how did you not go to school? I think part of it was like, how the hell did you get this job? And then the other half was just like, you can't not go. You have to go. Everyone goes. It's like, no, not really.
So did they actually inquire further to learn about you, or did they just judge you at that point and that was a full stop?
50-50. It was either awkward, okay, talk to you later. Or like, yeah, tell me more. How did this happen? And why did I go and do this if you didn't have to?
You know, we should be thinking critically, and that's the sort of, let's say, inquisitive nature that you would hope places like university would actually encourage. But it, you know, a lot of people seem to go through and, to my mind, waste that opportunity to think more openly and flexibly about things. And to your point about trade schools and stuff before, this is probably a very obscure paraphrase reference, but you've reminded me there's a particular line in the film The Matrix Reloaded where one of the characters, I think, says to Neo, people don't care how machines work as long as they work. And I think that can be applied to all of society. You think about 2020, all the things that kept things going, whether it was, you know, streaming services like Netflix for entertainment, or all underlying Amazon Web Services for every single website or e-commerce tool or video calling service that we use. All of these amazing things built by people of all different backgrounds and skills, university or not, kept the world going when we couldn't be physically present. But I'm sure a lot of people wouldn't actually care to look into how that stuff was done or who did it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that quote could literally cover everything in existence right now. I don't think people really do care about how things work as long as they're working. And then when they don't work, that's when they raise hell.
Yeah, and you don't need to necessarily have advanced scientific or computer knowledge. Like, I think it's fair to say your knowledge of computers and technology is much deeper than mine is, particularly when it comes to web development and all different things. I don't have those skills or that knowledge like you do, but I'm interested enough in how computers influence us or how we use them as a society. So not everyone has to be the same. Not everyone has to be an expert or specialized, but I think just being open to understanding how things connect, how media influence us, how we interact and work together, if you're more open to that, then you can achieve more or get to know others better.
Yeah, it's that universal language. Not everyone has to be fluent in every single language, but if you can at least understand some of the phrases and some of the common terminology, I think that just helps everyone. Thinking back to my previous jobs, I would do everything I could to understand how do operations people do what they do? How does finance work? Why do they always need these certain things? Instead of just saying, oh, they need the XYZ report again, I guess I'll go get that. It's like, what does this do? Why do you need this? Not in a antagonistic way, just why do you need this? What does this do for you to help our business keep going? I don't know. I'm very fascinated in what everyone else does, because I think we often take everyone else's job for granted that, oh, you know, finance screwed up again. Oh, IT, oh, they're the worst. And it's like, okay, yeah, but do you even understand what they're doing or why they're doing it or why this new policy change happened? And you know what? Maybe the new policy change is garbage and is terrible for everyone, but it came from somewhere, so it'd probably be good to figure out why that happened. And so I think just understanding, and again, coming back to that kind of people thing, be more people-focused in terms of school and work and not so much driven like a machine, because that's the worst thing that can happen is when that machine stops working, then you've waited far too long and things are just in a really bad place.
Yeah, it's good to be more people focused. And I think a lot of this comes down to the symptom of more and more specialization. And you can see the fragmentation of disciplines that used to be just under things like arts or sciences or business. There are more and more avenues to explore very, very specifically. And it's good to have very particular skills or if you have a very particular interest, but how can we think holistically and about each other and how everything fits together, to your point about finance and IT people? Because without them, you know, you wouldn't get paid or have a computer to use. Pretty obvious. So there's more fragmentation, there's more niche interest, which is cool for media consumption. But in terms of skills, the last episode I did with my friend Evan, he was talking about the phrase being a jack of all trades and master of none. Sometimes that can have a negative connotation, but to be a jack of all trades, to have a broad knowledge of lots of different things and to be open to stuff, you can be more appreciative of where people are coming from or the different skills that are required to run the world.
I take pride in being a jack of all. I'll be the first to label myself as a jack of all trades and master of none. I'm perfectly fine with that. I would much rather be able to be thrown into a situation and figure out a solution rather than just say, oh, this isn't my area, sorry. Mm-hmm. Like, that doesn't help anyone or you. That doesn't make, you don't look good because you're so perfect at only one thing and can do nothing else. No one's gonna look at you and go, oh, the God is here, but he can't help us with this problem. But at least he's super good at that one thing that's not relevant right now. So I'm perfectly thrilled being very well broad on being able to do just a lot of different things. Something that I'm thinking about now too, just to slightly shift, is from the work standpoint and how things are changing. I know forever, like I said, I lived in California, we lived in Silicon Valley. So everything, A, was very warped and B, was very tech centric, obviously. But the whole concept of things like open office was always a big buzzword, which I'm here to tell you, open offices have been, are still, and always will be complete bullshit, regardless of what anyone says. I will fight anyone on that. They're bad. But this has been the first thing ever, and by this I mean this past year, to actually challenge the idea of a giant open office of people. And it attacked it in many different ways. It wasn't just that we can't go to work now, but the whole premise of the pandemic is that we shouldn't be tightly packed together in one space. And that's exactly what an open office was. I'm curious if that's a thing where you're at too, this kind of idea of open office. I'm assuming it kind of got its claws into the world, but I see this as a positive outcome in the sense that this is actually now making businesses, big businesses, think, do we really need to have these million, billion, however many dollar giant campuses where everyone's got to be in the same place no matter what they do? Sometimes that makes sense. I will absolutely agree. Sometimes being in a room with two other people gets to the resolution the quickest way possible. You can look at a physical thing. Great, no problem there. The problem I've always had is when you have, and I guess it's knowledge work, I think is kind of the generalized term for a person that goes to work and sits in front of a computer for 8 hours and then goes home. Like, why do you need to be in a cube doing that at an office, taking up electricity, physical space, breathing up the air, driving to work for 2 hours, especially in the Silicon Valley area where you'd be in traffic hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, who knows, each way. So you've already lost that time to go sit in a room to do a thing to then go back home. If your option is work an extra hour at home or sit in traffic for 4 hours a day, you're probably going to take the option of the extra hour. But yet they never did it. It was always, nope, come into the office and, you know, burn that fuel into the air and waste all that time and energy. But now we're at a kind of a pretty big tipping point where things could change pretty drastically. I don't know if they will, but I really sure hope that they do.
Well, I'm interested in what you said about open plan offices, because I've worked in a few different places. And like you were saying, in the US, the open plan office is pretty common now. It's the thing. But you've reminded me about this great video by, I think it was news service Vox, you know, Vox,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
V-O-X, yep. In the US. Yeah. They did this great video, as they do a lot of explainer clips, about the open plan office and how the original concept for an open plan office was completely ruined or disturbed over time. And the point that it makes in the video, and I'll have to find it and put it in the show notes, is that originally the open plan office was supposed to be architecturally designed to be conducive to both private personal work and running into people to share that knowledge or have those serendipitous moments where you discover something or come up with an idea. The idea was that you would have different natural things set up around the office, like plants or columns or things that would reduce noise and allow people to be separated, but then still see each other and have that sharing, which is the whole point of making that long commute to actually be with people rather than in a cube, office or open plan or otherwise. So I think you make a great point about that. And I kind of wonder if that original vision for the open plan office, had it been carried through and not been ruined due to, let's say, different ideas or budget cuts or whatever interfered with it, would we have seen that same kind of disruption or need for everyone to work at home as we did with the pandemic if people were able to share the same space but be spaced apart in a way that was healthier? People have to go home because they're too close to each other.
Yeah.
That's the fact of the matter. It's the social distancing aspect. So I don't necessarily have a problem with open plan. I think there is something very good about it. And you get to be amongst people, which is really important. That's what work's all about. It's what life's about. But if it's not done properly, that's when everything gets disrupted and you have to find this new normal. So maybe we'll see more people working at home. I've had the great opportunity to do that myself and I've been very grateful and we've really made it work and kept in touch and used video calling service as well. So I feel very, very lucky personally in the position that I've been in, but a lot of people aren't in that position. So like you said, we have to reimagine what the work campus or office is to make it comfortable and safe for future events like this.
Yeah, I think the majority of open offices that I've seen slash been in, you know, they weren't working because of two things. They were laid out in such a way that everyone that was within the center part wore noise-canceling headphones just so they could get any kind of silence. And everyone that was generally, depending on the company, director or above, were all in closed-door offices all around the perimeter of this open floor plan. Obviously, it's not that great of an idea if it doesn't work for everyone. So I think that's pretty telling that it's not the best way to go about doing things. We can't just think knowledge workers, right? Because like there's a lot of service people that you can't serve food at a restaurant from home. It doesn't work, obviously. So there's still a lot of jobs that require people to go places. But I do feel that the idea of more people in this knowledge work type of situation being able to work from home does have some kind of trickle-down effect, in the sense of less people on the road, less people out taking up physical space and resources that could be used by people that actually need to go to a physical place to do something, and make it an option. Some people don't like working from home. I'm perfectly accepting of that. Some people are losing their minds this last year of, how the hell am I supposed to do my job from home? I hate it. It's terrible. It takes all kinds. So again, back to like with school, there should be choice. You know, if you want to work from home 3 days a week, 4 days a week, if the job's getting done and people are relatively happy overall, I don't really see there to be a problem with it. I'll be very interested to see if anything changes over the course of time in the next couple of years.
People work differently, just like they learn differently, as you said earlier on in this episode. And like you said about the trickle-down effects, I'm really interested to see how it even affects, assuming the things do remain changed or continue to change, pretty much a certainty, I think. How does that affect the way that our cities are designed? Because you think about how the post-war period really kicked off, whether it was in the US or Australia. Australia is in many ways kind of a cultural copycat of the US now. It was more British than Britain originally, but now it's just becoming little America in some ways, I think. So we're a bit confused. That's my opinion anyway. But, you know, you saw the rise of the suburb. You saw people commuting to their inner city jobs. And then as things got busier and busier and more people were doing this white collar or knowledge work, as you put, people want to try to live in the city in smaller apartments. But now suddenly that maybe isn't so important if you happen to have a desk job. So does that reinforce thinking about living rurally or regionally or in a suburb far away? Because now you actually don't have to commute to work or even be in the CBD. You can be far away and be connected through technology. So suddenly the assumptions that we were making about how urban design or our lives were heading, or where and how they were changing, it's changing again. So it feels like a bit of a mishmash at this point. We're still in the thick of it.
Yeah. Like several years ago, the big thing, at least around the, you know, the tech area, was we're going to build these big train, underground maglev train things, and you're going to be able to go from San Francisco to LA in 8 minutes or whatever. And that was kind of that was as far as the vision went of how you could work further away from where you needed to work and didn't have to live in the middle of San Francisco where, you know, rent is $8,000 a week or whatever. So it was like, well, we'll build trains and we'll just do it that way. That sounded great. And now looking back at that today, it feels a little short-sighted of, well, now you're still assuming that the person needs to physically go there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they don't even need to physically go there. They could do this virtual train through the internet via video or whatever. I think it's possible. The unfortunate thing is that I think the tools are still way behind in what we need. Side tangent, when I first went to work at Cisco years and years ago, like 2005, I think it was. Anyway, that's when telepresence as a product started kicking off, and I worked on that project for a while. And that was these big room systems where you got the, you know, if you look at a certain way, it looks like you're looking at the person. The audio was everything about it was perfect. It cost $1 million to build one, but that is beside the point. The fact that you were virtually somewhere without going there, the big thing was, we're going to change the world in terms of people aren't going to fly around the world anymore for business meetings. You're going to be able to hit, you know, 8 different meetings in an hour versus flying to one place. Takes 3 days to have a 1-hour meeting. Well, flash forward to now, the tools still kind of suck and they're not really that great in terms of, you know, talking over people. It's annoying. As soon as you get more than 3 or 4 people on a call, everything breaks down. You can't step away and have like a side conversation with someone. So the tools, I'll say they're good. I'm glad we've had them this last year. I think they really truly saved a lot of people a lot of anguish, but they're just not where they need to be if we're going to actually do this for real. As with most things, like you said, with the infrastructure physically, the tools, the digital infrastructure needs to be fixed if this is going to actually work, because we can't just have these crappy calls with the pixelation and the audio is out of sync and we're talking over each other. It just causes people to get upset about the situation rather than looking at the benefit of it, if I didn't have to go somewhere. So we've got a ways to go.
Yeah. And look, it's really helped us. I know when we've done the Hemispheric Views show, the three of us speaking together, we have a natural rhythm or chemistry, or we know how to speak to each other on the show, but there is always that little consideration. I don't know about you, about there is going to be some latency. There is going to be that little pause. Do I want to be the one who creates that crosstalk that some poor soul has to edit out of the show afterwards? So it ends up influencing cultural or creative output, and you can fix those things in post, but it's something to think about. So I think it's great that we have these tools. I agree with you. It's really empowered us with the way that we can work. And even though it does have its own huge energy consumption implications as far as the physical infrastructure for digital technology, it is hopefully saving on lots of airplane flights, lots of fuel being used. So if we can manage to make things higher quality but use less energy and create something that's more present in the moment, more in sync, the implications are huge. What kind of final rumination or even prediction for the future would you end for this episode to make people think about how all of these changes might relate to their own situation?
Two things. So first, I would just make a request to the audience. Please just turn on your video when you're doing these calls with people. It seems to be a real big stigma with people that they just don't want to turn the video on, whether it's a meeting for work or a personal thing. Just turn the video on. It just makes that connection that much stronger. I know for me, like even right now recording this, being able to pick up on any cue visually is just so helpful, and it makes you actually in the moment, right? Whereas if it's just audio, it's so easy for me to, oh, look at this. Now I'm over on my phone looking at something, not paying attention. Just be in the moment or don't be on the call. And that goes for work too. It just drives me nuts when I'm in a video meeting and it's my picture in the corner and then 15 boxes with initials in it. Just turn the damn video on, please. So branching off of that, what I would guess have people ruminate over is to try this stuff, use it. Don't just hate it for hating its sake. Everyone, I think it's become kind of fashionable to just be, oh, I got to do a video call. I hate the video call. Make it useful for you. I've always said, you know, in work, I would challenge people, does this meeting need to happen? And if it doesn't, then don't do it. Don't just do a meeting for the sake of doing a meeting. Don't just do a video call because you think you have to do a video call. Make it meaningful. You know, if you're going to talk to people, talk to them every couple of weeks instead of saying we're going to do it every week and then get burnt out on it. This is where we're at right now, and there's nothing you can do about it. Anyone. We're trying like hell to get vaccines out. Still doesn't matter. We're going to be doing this for a while. I know we thought that when the clock struck 12:01 on 2021, that everything was magically going to be fine again. But it's not, because look, we're almost in what? We're February now, going into March, April, May, June. We still have a ways to go. So I think if anything, I wouldn't say do a New Year's resolution, but try to just reset your own personal opinion on everything and make it work for you, and try to use these tools and make them work for us, and teach other people how to use them as well. Don't just assume everyone knows how to do all this stuff, because most people, they just don't. So do what you can, try to teach somebody something, and enjoy what we have while we have it, because it could be a hell of a lot worse. This could be 1998 and we're all on dial-up and you won't be able to see anyone for 11 months straight. That would be far worse.
Have you heard about that Y2K thing? I hear that's coming.
Make sure you turn your computer off before midnight.
Well, there's some great points. Thank you so much, Jason. It's been great to have you on.
Thank you.
A lot to think about, a lot to ruminate on for people listening. If people want to find you online, engage with you, learn some more, where should they go?
I would subscribe to the Hemispheric Views podcast. That's what I would do personally. But you can always find me everywhere online. Just go to burk.io.
Perfect. Well, thanks again for your time. And I'll see you soon on that other podcast that we do.
Sounds good.
Thanks, Jason.